Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for making the world part of your world by tuning into the show every day. We are grateful for your support. This year, the holiday season looks a lot different. Here at The World, we know what it's like to feel out of touch and uncertain about the future. That's why we strive to bring you honest stories that connect you with people around the globe. One thing you can be certain of is that The World team is dedicated to bringing you the coverage you need. Right now, though, The World needs you. Specifically, 578 dedicated listeners to donate $100 each to reach our goal. That's just $8.33 a month to support the stories we bring you each day. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we make the goal, and I know you'll get us there, I'll host a virtual celebration with the World team and send you an invite as a thank you for your support. Right now, go to theworld.org/give, and from everybody here at The World, thanks very much. Wear a mask, avoid large gatherings. Meantime, Europe is on track to ease restrictions for Christmas.
I don't think it's ill-advised or dangerous. I think it's calculating the risk and understanding what people want.
But is the risk worth it? Russia has started vaccinating people in Moscow following an aggressive timeline.
I think it's safe. The question is about efficacy of this vaccine.
Vaccinating people while the drug is still in trials. Also today, President-elect Joe Biden says he'll reunite migrant families separated at the U.S.-Mexico border, but Washington has not kept track of them.
So we couldn't even begin the searches by phone trying to contact these families.
Reuniting people when you don't know where they are. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here this Monday. Christmas is less than 3 weeks away. In Canada, the premier of Manitoba, Brian Pallister, is acting as the Grinch. He said this year, stay apart.
I'm the guy who's stealing Christmas to keep you safe. Because you need to do this now. You need to do the right thing. Because next year, we'll have lots to celebrate. And we'll celebrate this year if we do the right thing this year.
In Europe, it's a much different story. Nations including Britain, France, and Germany are on track to partially ease their coronavirus lockdowns for the Christmas holidays. Leaders appear willing to take this risk, even though lifting restrictions could cause cases of COVID to skyrocket. But how big a risk is it really? To find out, let's turn to David Heyman. He's a professor of infectious disease at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Heyman says Europe's plan to loosen restrictions for the holidays will not repeat the mistakes made when countries came out of lockdown last May.
I think they've learned a lesson from not opening up everything just overnight, and they've maintained close down of certain areas and enforcing certain rules in restaurants, in nightclubs, which are completely closed down in many places, in pubs and in various places. So what they're hoping is that they've compensated for an increase in transmission where they know it occurs, which is in those sites. And they're really taking a risk on letting families get together, which is what families themselves want. And what's been important is that they get people who are attending family events the right messaging. And that is that if you've been exposed to what might have been a Christmas party or something which might have caused increased transmission to you, then you have to remember that you're going to visit with people who are elderly and who maybe become sick because of you. You know, everything is now building a ship as we're sailing, and European countries have decided to take this risk.
It's about assessing risk. I understand that. But do you think it's right to be making calculations around human life and well-being?
You know, the best would be for each individual to be able to make his or her own risk assessment. That's what we do for other infections such as syphilis, HIV, tuberculosis. We decide if we're going to go visit people who are sick or who might be sick.
But decisions like this impact not just individual freedom. These are risks that will impact others potentially. How would you frame it, David Heyman, in terms of striking that balance?
In Europe, the risk that has been the most severe for countries to accept is the risk on their hospitals, that they won't be able to take care of the patients who come to their hospitals. And so all the measures that Europeans have developed have been to keep admissions in hospitals from COVID-19 at a low level so they don't have an increase in hospitalizations and an overwhelming of the hospital system and increased mortality. In other parts of the world, in Asia, for example, their calculation is to identify where transmission is occurring and shut it down, rather than shutting down the whole society as has been done in Europe. So Europe is gradually coming around, perhaps, to that understanding that they don't need to shut down everything. They need to shut down certain areas where transmission is known to be occurring, and they need to let people begin to take more of a risk.
What about your own personal risk calculation, Professor Heyman? How are you thinking about the holidays?
My risk calculation is such that I know where my children are going, where the grandchildren have been, and I'm willing to take certain risks in order to be with them at Christmas time.
In other words, you would be in an enclosed space with closed windows and masks, or get more specific, what does that look like?
We will be getting together, and if the day is nice, certainly we'll leave the doors open and leave adequate ventilation to come through. If not, then we'll have to figure out other ways of making sure that we maintain a distance, especially when we're sitting at the table or sitting speaking, because we don't want those aerosols that are created to spread from one to the other.
David Heyman is a professor of infectious disease at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Good to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The reality is that we will not all be vaccinated by Christmas, not by a long shot. Vaccine rollouts will take many, many months. There are logistical challenges and ethical dilemmas, like who gets the vaccine first and which countries get access first. Last week, the president of the UN General Assembly, Volkan Bozkir, said the process must be fair and equitable.
Providing everyone with access to COVID-19 vaccines is both the right thing to do and the smart thing to do.
But as wealthy nations are buying up early vaccine supplies, a key effort pushing for fair global access is facing a massive challenge. Here's the world's Ilana Gordon.
In economics, there is this nearly 200-year-old concept. It's called the tragedy of the commons. And here's what happens. There's a common field and a group of shepherds. The shepherds let all their sheep eat grass off that field.
But because everyone is focusing on their own sheep, the grass gets eaten down to the roots and everyone's sheep die.
That is David McAdams, an economist at Duke University. This story of individuals motivated to take resources for themselves and then harming the collective good has been through countless iterations over time. And McAdams and his global health colleagues have been thinking a lot about it as individual nations now vie for COVID-19 vaccines. The U.S. has poured billions into getting an effective vaccine. And as lead scientific advisor Moncef Slaoui on Good Morning America said, is almost there.
I hope by the 10th or the 11th of December, Pfizer vaccine is approved.
Brazil is securing direct vaccine deals. Same for Australia, Canada, Japan, Germany, and France. And so McAdams wonders, are we living through another tragedy as wealthy nations hoard the majority of the COVID-19 vaccine supply?
So it certainly feels that way because everyone's trying to graze their own sheep. They're trying to get doses for their own people.
A recent study by health researchers, also at Duke University, predicted that billions of people in low-income countries could be waiting until at least 2023 for vaccines if wealthier nations only lock in their own supply. But there is a global mechanism that was formed early in the pandemic to break this hoarding pattern, a pattern that has played out in past pandemics. The effort is called COVAX.
Look, this is a test of the world.
Rajiv Venkaya is with a COVID-19 vaccine manufacturer and is also an independent advisor to one of the groups that runs COVAX. He says for COVAX to work, a lot of countries have to join, and the wealthy ones have to invest in it. Think of COVAX like a global buyers club that invests in multiple vaccines and then secures deals for everyone who takes part, even the lower-income countries. COVAX then distributes the supply equitably across participating nations.
It is bringing together all of the countries that have an interest in securing vaccine for their populations and pooling the financial resources from those countries or for those on behalf of those countries to be able to negotiate reservations of volumes from vaccine manufacturers.
The World Health Organization helps oversee COVAX. On Friday, WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned a United Nations special session on the pandemic that COVAX might not succeed.
Unless fully funded, it is in danger of becoming no more than a noble gesture.
At least 189 countries have signed on to COVAX. Notably absent are the United States and Russia. Ghebreyesus says COVAX needs billions more in funding to meet its goals and contain the pandemic before it destroys the global economy.
Sharing the fruits of science is not charity. It is in the best of interest of every nation.
McAdams, the economist from Duke, says there's a sensible way to design incentives and manufacturing deals that benefit the global good.
The fundamental and most important distinction is whether your deal is grabbing vaccines, so you're taking away from others, or whether you're growing vaccines. Depending on how you structure your deal, you can make a deal that benefits you, gets doses for your people, but also accelerates availability of doses for everyone else.
Right now, some of these vaccine deals do this. Others don't. The world is at a pivotal moment as more of these decisions are being made. McAdams says if COVAX gets more financing and support, it could move things in a direction that's good for everyone. What also gives him and others hope is that if more vaccines beyond the Pfizer's prove effective, that could mean even more grass for more of us sheep in the commons. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
4 years ago, American diplomats in Cuba began coming down with mysterious symptoms: memory loss, headaches, blurred vision. It came to be known as Havana syndrome. Since then, other diplomatic workers in China and Russia came forward with similar experiences. So the State Department approached the National Academies of Sciences and asked them to investigate. The findings have now been released to the public. Dr. David Relman is a professor at Stanford and chairman of the committee that wrote the report. Welcome back, Dr. Relman. We've spoken about your report in general terms in the past, but we couldn't go beyond that because it was a confidential document. Now it's public. What is your conclusion about Havana syndrome?
For many of these people, in the middle of the night, they were awakened to the sudden perception of a loud screeching sound, pain in the head, a sensation of pressure or even buffeting, the way you might experience if you're driving down the highway with a back window of your car open. What made this even more unusual was that these folks sensed that the phenomenon was coming from a particular direction, often from, let's say, outside the bedroom. And further, that when they moved, the sensations stopped. So this is something that some, you know, world-class neurologists on our committee said to us, we have heard nothing ever of this sort before. This is unique.
So the report refers to directed pulse radio frequency waves. Does that mean this radiation was intentionally targeted certain people? In other words, are we talking about a weapon or an attack here?
We, on the one hand, were not really in a position to be able to comment upon intentionality or deliberateness or who did these things and how they took place. However, we do believe that the form of microwave radiation that we're talking about is a form that is not common in the world around us. Instead, it's a form of microwave radiation that is pulsed and directional in its origins and source. So presumably, it was something that may have been delivered or created with intention.
We should point out that Canadian diplomats in Cuba were also impacted by this syndrome, correct?
That's correct. We were also limited in the amounts and kinds of information we were given. So on the score of the Canadians, we were told very little about individual cases. In fact, nothing about individual cases. So it's hard for us to comment upon the Canadian experiences. However, when we did look at plausible mechanisms and looked at this whole issue of pulsed microwave radiation, we found that a lot of this literature, open literature, was published in the Russian language over many decades from not just the former Soviet Union, but affiliated satellite states. There clearly was interest in understanding the health effects of this form of microwave radiation by the Soviets and by others around the world. I mean, this, like many technologies, presumably is also now much more well disseminated and of interest to many parties for many different reasons, presumably.
The last time we spoke, the report had been completed and submitted to the State Department, but not released, which I know was a source of frustration for you. How are you feeling now that members of Congress have seen this report and it's been released publicly?
We're heartened. There's been an outcry of interest and of expressed determination to really understand what's going on better. There are a number of people who now assert that there are cases continuing. So this is not an issue of past interest. This is something that I think should be of great interest, and I think is now, to our government leaders, to our representatives, and to the many institutions that can do useful work in this area.
David Roman is a professor at Stanford and the chairman of a committee at the National Academies of Sciences that investigated Havana syndrome. That report is out and now public. Dr. Roman, thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest.
Two U.S. presidents have had to deal with a war in Syria. Now it's Joe Biden's turn. That's coming up. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Bashar al-Assad is one of the only constants in Syria's deadly civil war after nearly a decade of fighting. In that time, two American presidents, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, have directed American policy towards Syria. In January, a third U.S. president, Joe Biden, will take on that job. Wael El-Zayat is the CEO of Mgage, a Muslim advocacy organization. He formerly worked on the Syria desk at the State Department and most recently served as a volunteer on the Biden campaign Syria policy team. Wael, thanks for being with us. What would you say is the consensus view among Joe Biden's foreign policy team regarding the conflict in Syria?
Thank you for having me on. I mean, certainly there is a realization and somewhat, I think, regret that more was not accomplished in terms of protecting civilians in Syria, but with the recognition that the now almost decade-long conflict is multidimensional and complicated, and it's not really only the role of the United States to fix it. I think it'll be interesting to see once the new administration enter office what that will translate into. I know, for example, that Tony Blinken, who's been nominated to become the next Secretary of State, has personally expressed deep concern and also regret regarding the ongoing crisis there and the inability of all of us. I was in the Obama administration to really do more for Syrian civilians.
So take us inside the team, Wael, and how they view Assad, the Assad dynasty, and what the future of Syria looks like. Isn't Assad the main obstacle to a stable Syria?
I think there is pretty much consensus that, you know, Assad is responsible for the overwhelming portion of the tragedy and the misery that has befallen the country and really is a main driver for instability in Syria. The question is, well, what do you do about it, given the constraints that are inherent to Syria, to the region? You know, we also have, obviously, Russia, Iran, Turkey, the Arab Gulf states, European interests, all intersecting in Syria.
So in what key ways could a Biden administration approach Syria differently than the Trump or Obama administrations? What is the vision?
I know that in politics, you always, you know, want to distinguish yourself from perhaps your opponents. But I got to say, on Syria, you are going to see a similar thread continuing from the Obama through the Trump and potentially through a Biden administration, of course, where you're going to see a recognition that perhaps there needs to be an increased investments in diplomacy and engagement with both the Russians, the Europeans, the Arab countries, the Turks, and perhaps even the Iranians, if there's a return discussions on the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement, regarding the fate of Syria. In terms of the physical, you know, as they say, boots on the ground, I really doubt that they will immediately withdraw troops, because those troops are serving a very important function in protecting civilian communities in the Northeast. And as small as the number is, it still provides the United States with certain, you know, or a degree of leverage.
More diplomatic activity would be a change, but as you know, a lot of critics have said U.S. policy towards Syria has kind of been a non-policy. They often point to Obama's famous red line on Syria, one that he did not back up after Assad used chemical weapons. I'm guessing that red line will shadow Biden when he moves into the White House. What does that legacy mean for him? And if push comes to shove again, will Biden similarly draw a red line? And do you think he'll enforce it?
Well, what I can tell you is Joe Biden is going to have his own style and his own presidency. And I think it's very important for people not to automatically conflate the two. We have to judge the next administration based on its own actions and the reality it faces on the ground. The question is, can you freeze the conflict officially? Can you ramp up support to communities, including those who are under Assad's control? Can you allow for some refugees to start returning? And then can you put together a more credible political dialogue process?
So on paper, while it sounds like you're saying there is a window for diplomacy, do you think that a political solution can be achieved in Syria if Biden were to push hard enough? And what would that look like?
Yeah, look, the big factor is always going to be not what a Biden administration may hope to do or want to do. Ultimately is Assad and his backers, mainly in Tehran, but also in Moscow. At what point are they willing to pressure that regime to concede just enough to reach a political solution?
It is hard to know how much Assad will be willing to play ball with any of this. All the sanctions have been a part of Washington's Syria policy. The U.S. slapped congressionally backed sanctions on the Assad regime. How effective has that been? And if they continue under the Biden administration, what are the carrots and sticks that will be used to either increase or decrease sanctions?
Well, the sanctions on Syria have been quite effective in limiting the regime's ability and its front companies and shell companies and members of, you know, and loyalists to Assad to conduct legal interactions on the international financial markets and turn that into, you know, bullets, guns, and salaries of militiamen that have been, you know, committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing in Syria for a decade. So there's always going to be challenges. And I think this is a role for the next administration to examine the sanctions regime, take an honest assessment of identifying areas that need to be improved, need to be modified to alleviate any unintended harm that's being caused by it.
As part of its ban on Muslim-majority countries, the Trump administration stopped Syrians from entering the United States. How do you think this might change under Biden? Do you see him taking the oath of office and turning around and kind of zapping that?
Well, the short answer is yes. We have full faith that this racist, bigoted ban will be repealed. You know, it's been a shame that the United States not only shut its door to those refugees, but it kind of signaled to other nations that it is okay to turn back asylum seekers and refugees just because of their race or religion.
Wael, as a Syrian American, how difficult has it been for you to witness the continued suffering of people in Syria after now a decade of conflict? And what are your hopes as Biden, a man you campaigned for, takes on this tragic war?
Look, as a human being, it was horrible to watch. It's horrible to watch still today. And I certainly hope that the Biden administration, while recognizing the limitations on the United States, that they will take these issues seriously and that they will muster all of our collective energies and abilities with like-minded countries. But you have to begin with a political will. You have to communicate that to your population. I think the American public is an incredibly generous and welcoming public if it is communicated with and motivated properly. And I think the rest of the world will follow on these humanitarian issues. And I don't think we can afford another 10 years of misery for the Syrian people. There will literally be nothing left of Syria.
Wael Al-Zayat is the CEO of Engage, a Muslim advocacy organization. Wael, really appreciate the conversation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The world takes you from what is next for the U.S. and Syria to efforts to ensure global access to COVID-19 vaccines. You join us every day for stories that inform you and keep you connected to the world. Continue that connection on social media. Follow us on Twitter, share those stories, and connect with the journalists who report them. On Twitter, we are @TheWorld. A reminder to our listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to bring you human-centered journalism that connects you with people and events beyond our borders. During this holiday season, when many of us can't meet in person, that human connection is more important than ever. Help us keep the show available to everybody across the globe with your gift of $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we reach our goal, you'll get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. If you've considered donating but haven't actually done it yet, then today is the day to take intention and turn it into action, one we at the show will be deeply grateful for. Just head to theworld.org/give. Thank you. There will be a lot on President-elect Joe Biden's desk when he takes office in January, including keeping promises he made on the campaign trail. One of those is to create a task force to reunite migrant families separated at the border by the Trump administration. KQED's Michelle Wiley reports on why that job will not be easy.
At the final presidential debate in October, Biden strongly condemned the Trump policy that led border agents to take children away, to prosecute parents, and deter migration.
Their kids were ripped from their arms and separated. And now they cannot find over 500 of sets of those parents, and those kids are alone.
In fact, it's a lot more than 500 families. Since Trump took office, more than 5,000 children have been separated. And while thousands of parents have been located, that leaves many kids still in limbo, over 3 years later. As part of a lawsuit settlement, advocates and lawyers are still trying to find parents who lost their kids in 2017. Often the only way is through lengthy searches on the ground in Central America, mostly in Guatemala and Honduras. The government didn't keep track of families and hasn't provided good contact numbers.
So we couldn't even begin the searches by phone trying to contact these families.
That's ACLU lawyer Lee Gallant, who represents the parents in the ongoing lawsuit against the Trump administration. Some nonprofits, like the ACLU, have taken the reins to find and reunify families, but it's a slow, arduous process. It can involve walking through small towns in, say, rural Guatemala, trying to track down a mom or dad with only an outdated address to go on. Biden has said he'll prioritize reunifying these families, but so far he hasn't offered details. Gallant says there are some things that would help, like allowing parents deported without their kids to return to the U.S. legally.
They have been through so much, and I think the least we can do now is to provide them with some status. I think what many people are not aware of is even once we reunite the families, they're still going through the trauma of fighting their deportation.
He also suggested the government create a fund for the families to get trauma counseling and other health care. And, he says, Biden should stop the separations that are still happening. The federal judge who blocked Trump's original policy has allowed border officials to take kids when they believe the parent is unfit or a danger. That's happened to more than 1,100 children, sometimes, Gallant says, for minor reasons, like a DUI.
We do not want the kinds of separation decisions that occur under the Trump administration made by CBP and ICE officials, where they are unilaterally declaring, without evidence most of the time, that the parent is a danger to the child.
Gallant says separation decisions should be based on child welfare standards. He and other advocates also want more recently separated families to be included in the lawsuit. But even separated families who received some legal protection from the lawsuits are still suffering as a result of the Trump policies and the terrible choices they were forced to make.
I remember one in particular who had been separated from his 7-year-old son.
Erica Pinero is the director of litigation for Al Otro Lado, a California nonprofit working on behalf of immigrant families. She said the man and his son came to the U.S. to seek asylum in 2018. The boy was taken from him at the border, and though the man had suffered violence and discrimination back home, it was unlikely he would qualify for protection.
And he had definitely suffered violence and was being threatened, but it was really difficult to fit his story into any category that confers eligibility under U.S. law.
He ultimately made the painful decision to accept deportation while his son stayed in the U.S. with an aunt.
So the only choices are bring your child back to a situation where you are receiving deadly threats or leave them in the United States and potentially never see them again.
Despite the difficult task ahead, Pinero's hopeful that Biden is committed to repairing the damage.
We see definite opportunity with the Biden administration, much more an opportunity than we would have had with the Trump administration fighting reunifications every step of the way.
But she says it remains to be seen who will be on the next president's task force and how far they're willing to go to make these families whole again. For The World, I'm Michelle Wiley in San Diego.
Returning to the latest news on the pandemic, in the UK, a vaccine rollout is beginning this week. They're not the first country to move ahead with this. Russia approved its Sputnik V vaccine months ago, and a mass vaccination campaign is now underway in Moscow. For more on the Sputnik V vaccine, I've got Irina Yakutenko with us. She's a Russian science writer and the author of a new book about the pandemic, The Virus That Broke the Planet. Irina, what are the most important things to know about the Russian Sputnik V vaccine? Fill us in.
Yeah, actually, the most important thing that we know about Sputnik V, or Sputnik V, actually, no one knows exactly how to pronounce it, is that we don't have enough information about it. There was one publication in peer review journal about the phase 1 and 2. They were combined, and that's all. Despite this fact, they have started vaccination on Saturday.
So very little information. Let me ask you this. Has it been approved, or, I mean, is it still being tested?
Yes. So it was actually approved, but the phase 3 clinical trials is not finished yet. So we don't have any publication. We have only press release from the Sputnik V developers. That's a very uncommon practice in Russia with this vaccine. So with this unusual speed, they decided to do like that.
Irina, what is your personal level of confidence in the Sputnik V vaccine?
There is not the question of my personal confidence, because in science, we trust in expertise, not in personal confidence. And so personally, I think that it's not it's a bad story to develop vaccines like that. But if you ask me about vaccination, so I think it's better now in Russia for doctors and teachers and social workers to be vaccinated, because we have not very good situation with epidemiological situation, a lot of cases. So I think it's better to vaccinate. I hope there are not many side effects. We didn't hear about it. So I think it's safe. But the question is about efficacy of this vaccine.
What about skepticism around Sputnik V? Are people enthusiastic about getting vaccinated in Russia? Or are you sensing a large part of the public is leery?
Some of them are enthusiastic. They're like patriots in sense that they believe that people in power know what they're doing. And some people are skeptic. There were a couple of surveys, and they found out that not so many Russians eager to be vaccinated. There were rumors that not all people who need to be vaccinated will do this voluntarily. Because, for example, teachers and doctors, so we can imagine that they will be banned from work if they won't be vaccinated. So we have in Russia this laws that I think in other countries also, that doctors and teachers and so on, they cannot go to work if they haven't been vaccinated against measles, against influenza and other diseases. So one can imagine that if they include coronavirus, teachers, doctors, and others, they must have this vaccine.
You recently published a book about the pandemic explaining the coronavirus to the Russian public. It seems to be getting a fair amount of attention. Is that what prompted you to write this book in the first place, that there just was not enough accurate information about mitigation, about how to be safe?
Oh, yeah, of course, that's one of the reasons. The main reason is that I like writing, so it's my job, so I like writing about science. I like reading about science and writing about it. But yes, so I started to trace the news about this pandemic starting from, I think, January. At the end of the spring, I felt that I need to pick up all the facts in one book to make this guide, because there were so many information that is not reliable, that is false, that it's very dangerous. They were very harmful about antibiotics, about some drugs that are not effective. So I felt that I have a responsibility, because I'm a molecular biologist. I understand what the scientists are writing about. And it's like a kind of my responsibility to pick up all these facts in one book that people can use as a guidance here in this sea of misinformation and false news, fake news about coronavirus.
Russian science writer Irina Yakutenko is the author of a new book titled The Virus That Broke the Planet. She's been speaking with us about the rollout in Moscow of the Russian vaccine Sputnik V. Irina, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you a lot.
Many people have been confronting racism in 2020. It's been happening across the globe with an acknowledgement of systemic racism in so many aspects of life and work. That includes within the news industry. In New Zealand, a media giant there called Stuff is now taking responsibility for racist treatment toward indigenous Maori people. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Hayley Caroy is a Maori woman who's grown up in New Zealand. As she's gotten older, she's realized her limited options for how to deal with the media.
You either have to live in the reality of the fact that the media, which is this really huge and elusive thing, is up against you, and what you know is your inherent value and self-worth. Or you have to internalize what they tell you and who they tell you that you are.
For her, that's a lose-lose situation. Karoy now works in public health for Indigenous peoples and is a strong advocate for her community. She says Maori are often depicted as being angry, violent, and lacking a full range of emotions.
We're never really allowed to be portrayed as joyful or happy. It's like you're invisible.
New Zealand's largest media publisher, called Stuff, agrees. In their recent apology, editorial director Mark Stevens wrote that their coverage of Maori issues over the past 160 years ranged from racist to blinkered. He continued, "If we've been monocultural in our reporting, and we haven't been diverse. Therefore, we haven't always been trustworthy." The apology comes after an internal investigation, during which around 20 Stuff journalists analyzed the company's portrayal and representation of Maori in its publications. Carmen Parahi, an editor at Stuff, spearheaded the project.
One Saturday in June, I actually had enough. I was about to walk away from journalism, but I decided that actually I'm going to fight for this because I'd had enough about the way Maori were being portrayed and put down.
As a Maori woman herself, Parahi told One News this was personal. Her grandfather kept a scrapbook of letters to the editor submitted by newspaper readers.
So when he passed away, I saw those letters to the editor. They were so racist and horrible. And he had kept them all that time, and he had shaped his life around those letters to the editor.
The fact that a Maori woman was the driving force behind the apology came as no surprise to Hayley Karoy. She says the acknowledgement is a good place for Stuff to start, but it leaves her with an outstanding question.
How much have non-Maori within the organisation actually bought into, and how much do they actually believe the apology, you know, that's been publicly made through this statement? Because an apology, in my humble opinion, is changed behaviour.
Aspects of Stuff's behaviour have begun to change. For example, they've partnered with the Maori Language Commission to get more editorials printed in both English and the Maori language. Here's Commissioner Rauenia Higgins.
As we kind of increase the visibility of the language, it signals the value that our nation is placing on our Indigenous language, to be able to embrace that more readily.
Stuff isn't the country's only publisher being called on to apologize for their history of racism. The New Zealand Herald is under pressure to release a similar statement. For now, Hayley Karoy says she's sticking with Maori-led media.
I believe in the spaces that we've created for ourselves, and I would rather invest there with people who I know are as equally invested as I am, and seeing Maori really thrive and see themselves as like humans with potential.
Stuff says that's the mission they're committed to as well. Apologies are hollow without a commitment to change to do better in the future, the company's statement read. They say they've now begun that journey and have much distance to travel. For The World, I'm Bianca Hellier.
A Russian-brokered peace deal has stopped the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. This is the region in the Caucasus Mountains between Armenia and Azerbaijan, where there's been a long simmering conflict for decades. The latest round of hostilities forced thousands of people from their homes. But as Andrew Connolly reports from the region, some of those people are starting to get back to normal lives.
This cramped NGO office in central Yerevan is a hive of activity. Workers pack and stack boxes with essential food, medicine and clothes. It's all destined for some of the tens of thousands of people from in and around Nagorno-Karabakh who've ended up here in Armenia's capital. Grigor Yeritsyan is president of the group called Armenian Progressive Youth. He says that even though thousands have started returning to the contested region since an armistice was signed on November the 10th, many more won't due to the ongoing disruption to education, healthcare and other services.
For many, when they left, their house was still there, but maybe it's not there anymore. We also had instances when kids are facing some psychological problems and also have some panic attacks and diseases related to constant fear. I don't think these families would think to go back in the near future.
Because of the trauma of the explosions and having to run away and everything.
Because of all the trauma they have been exposed to.
During the fighting this fall, the mountaintop city of Shushi in Nagorno-Karabakh was captured by Azerbaijan. This represents one of the most painful losses for Armenia. Grigor's colleagues are delivering supplies here to Larisa Melkumyan and her husband. They're sheltering in a wooden house outside the capital, Yerevan. Larisa was a music teacher in Shushi and recounts her escape.
We stayed in the basement for 4 days and then fled at night as the road was being bombed. The owner said we could stay here for a while for free, but we don't know how long that will last.
As we speak, Russian military planes pass overhead. According to the Russia-brokered peace agreement, Moscow will deploy its troops in Nagorno-Karabakh to prevent clashes between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Melkumyan continues, while her husband stares into the distance behind her.
My sons-in-law and husband were fighting. They saw terrible things, and they're still in shock. But the past is for forgetting, and we should live in the future. We miss our Shushi, but we can't get it back.
On a recent morning in the main market of Stepanakert, the de facto capital of Nagorno-Karabakh, there are signs of life starting to get back to normal. Chickens rattle their cages, a butcher is selling cow's heads, and crates of pomegranates, peppers and potatoes line the street. During the war, a rocket attack destroyed a clothes store here. It's little more than a burnt shell with shards of glass and wood and ripped fabric spilling out onto the street. Next door, Rima Arushanyan is doing a brisk trade in fresh eggs and homemade vodka. She says that several hundred people are returning to the city every day, and business is picking up.
Thank God nobody was here at the time when the missile hit. The owner is still on the front line, and now his business is gone. But at least nobody died, and everything that is destroyed can be rebuilt.
Stepanakert was shelled throughout the war. Electricity and gas supplies are still interrupted, but most of the city is intact. Up on the front lines is a different story. Levitan Danielian plucks some juicy persimmons from the trees in his garden and washes them under the tap. They still have a layer of dust from when a missile exploded outside the pensioner's house. That was the same night the peace agreement was signed. They hit us with everything they had, he says. All night long they shelled the whole neighborhood, and thankfully everyone on this street is okay. It wasn't always this way. Under the Soviet Union, Armenians and Azerbaijanis lived right alongside each other. But Danielian says it wasn't perfect, even then. The Soviet government didn't let anyone do anything nationalistic, he says. Thanks to that, we live together, but not really as friends, more like dogs and cats. As we speak, I spot a few bright new bricks in Levitan's garden wall, and I ask if he's starting to rebuild already. He says, Azerbaijan shelled my house in the 90s. When the war ended in 1994, I asked the Armenian government for some assistance. Years later, they finally decided to give me some building supplies. Those new bricks, he tells me, they arrived here on September 26, the day before the Second War. Armenian troops were ordered to leave several regions surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh last month. Now, the enclave's sole connection to Armenia is a single, long, dusty road that weaves through mountains and plunging gorges. Until a new one is built, Armenians and Azerbaijanis will have to share this road under the watchful eye of Russian peacekeepers. They've set up numerous checkpoints along the road. All along this mountain pass are pieces of missiles and shreds of military uniforms. The battle for Shushi was one of the war's bloodiest. According to the latest government figures, both Armenia and Azerbaijan lost around 2,500 soldiers in just 44 days of fighting. Azerbaijan was the clear military winner, but people living here will now have to rely on Russia to keep the peace. For the world, Andrew Connolly, Nagorno-Karabakh.
One more story for you today, the seemingly endless heights of human ability.
It is without doubt well inside world record pace here.
Yesterday, the Spanish city of Valencia held a half marathon. It was a tight race among a pack of five men until Kenyan Kibiwak Kandi somehow found a hidden reserve of power and ran like no one ever before. The announcer didn't hide his excitement. Candy set a new world record of 57 minutes and 32 seconds, smashing the previous best by a full 29 seconds. In other words, maintaining a pace of 4 minutes and 23 seconds per mile for 13.1 miles. Wow. Here's Candy talking about breaking away from the pack toward the end of the race.
I make a move and progressively I say no one to follow me because I needed the world record. No, to lift a victory to Kiblimo.
Kiblimo, as in Jacob Kiblimo from Uganda, who came in second yesterday, just 5 seconds off the pace, which also broke last year's world record. In fact, yesterday, an astonishing 4 men beat the previous world record time. Simply incredible. The women's side also had a record. Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba, running in her first ever half marathon competition, came in at just over 65 minutes, a record for a half marathon debut. As for us, we've reached our finish line for today, but we're always running at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with more tomorrow.